Well, had we been here last week, instead of home drinking a lot of milk and making sandwiches, because I'm sure that's what we're all doing with all that bread and milk we buy when bad weather comes in. Although I think the ice cream shelf was pretty empty at the store as well, and the potato chip rack. But last week would have been almost exactly 19 years since I was originally in the Book of Ruth. That was the first time that I had walked through an exposition, and I thoroughly enjoyed Ruth at that time, and I am very much enjoying it again. Now, Ruth is a magnificent story that is told within a seemingly insignificant family. It's a story of famine and hardship and tragedy and loss, with questionable decisions being made laced with blessings that are, at their time at least, unseen. In it, we're going to find deep loyalty, honor, and covenant love and faith, all wrapped up in a family dynamic secured by the providence of God for a greater purpose and a greater story than the one that they were at that time living, as their family story in the bigger picture that God is in becomes our family here. Now, the book of Ruth is a part of five books that are read in Israel during the feast. They're referred to as the five megalos, or the five scrolls. Ruth, because of the connection to the harvest, is read during the Feast of Pentecost, or the Feast of Harvest. And Ruth herself is one of only five women listed in the genealogy of Jesus, a list which includes Tamar, the daughter-in-law of Judah, who deceived him into getting her pregnant in order to keep her part of the family inheritance, and Rahab, the harlot of Jericho, who helped the Hebrew spies escape from Jericho. Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah, who was really set up to be murdered, so to speak, in battle, but still set up, because she was indeed the mistress of David and also the mother of Solomon. And Mary, the wife of Joseph, mother of Jesus. So minus Mary, a despised Moabitess woman like Ruth is not out of place in this list of women. God does indeed act in mysterious ways. He does things we would not think that he would do. Let's go to Ruth and read verses 1 through 7 in the first chapter of Ruth. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, the name of his two sons Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they came into the country of Moab and continued there. And Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. And they took them wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, not Oprah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelled there about 10 years. And Mahlon and Chilion died also, both of them, and the woman was left of her two sons and her husband. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law, that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab how that the Lord had visited his people in giving them bread. Wherefore she went forth out of the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return unto the land of Judah. Now Ruth begins actually more like a classic novel than a historical record. It says, now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled, is the way you kind of think of a novel starting out. When we hear that opening and we picture fire-breathing dragons perhaps, or great armored warriors wielding swords. But really, that would not come close to the actual picture here. In brief, after the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan River and then to the Promised Land, the land was conquered and divided up specifically among the tribes of Israel. And Joshua continued as the appointed head of the tribes until his death at the age of 110 years old. Now, after his death, no one stood in his place. And with no central leadership, no central government, no king, so to speak, the tribes became distant and divided from each other. Judges 21:25 sums it up by saying that in those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Only 45 years after the death of Joshua, the tribes had drifted already into idolatry. Judges 2:10 says, "There arose a generation which knew not the Lord, nor even the works that he had done for Israel." The history of the era of the judges, which covers, your guess is as good as mine, a few hundred years. When you try to sit down and figure it out, it could be anywhere from 180 to 350, depending upon which scholar, if you think of that as a scholarship there, whichever scholar you happen to be listening to. But what it really reveals, regardless of how long it was a cycle in which Israel falls into apostasy. God sends a foreign nation to oppress them. They repent. And then the Lord sends a deliverer to restore them. Those are the judges. It was really a history of a roller coaster ride where it was soil, wash, rinse, and repeat. Over and over again. Samuel was one of the last of the judges, as well as a prophet and priest in the land. Now, it's important to see the times in which Ruth exists, because this is not the structured, governed Israel we generally think of. This is not that. This is a loose confederation of tribes, often lawless and unstable. That's the way Israel was in Ruth's day. To which we add hardships of a famine to the mix. But it is a famine that kickstarts an incredible series of events in the life of this Naomi, her husband, and sons. Now, as much as we need to have some, at least, brief understanding of the times in which this exists, we need to see these times for context by looking at the hand of the God that directs those times. He's not just fixing things as he goes. He's not reacting to what's happening. He's in control. He is the God who moves an insignificant family towards a magnificent goal. He's the God who directs the weather and directs the tribes, and far as forward as we want to go to today and on into the future, directs even our own steps right now. What we often dismiss in our lifetime, as they did less in their day, but we often dismiss in our lifetime, we attribute some evil thing happening to us or some bad thing occurring to some other cause. It's global warming or something. And yet in reality, he sits sovereignly over and controls all things for his purposes. And he does not do what we think he would do or should do. I always like to refer back to 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 26 through 29, so we can hear this very clearly, talking about our calling as believers. And he says in 26, "For you see your calling, brethren, how not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called." It's not the people we place on pedestals that are called, at least not in great numbers. 27, "But God hath chosen," what? "The foolish things of the world to confound the wise, And God has chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty, and the base things of the world, and things which are despised hath God chosen, yea, and things which are nothing, to bring to naught things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. God is at work, doing a work, even in a famine, even in an insignificant family in Bethlehem, Judah, doing his work, his purpose. And even in retrospect, it's impossible to know for sure in all of its fullness what God is doing. Ruth is a divine appointment on the way to Christ, a point of intersection in the redemptive thread of history. No matter how hard I try, I will not be able to mine the fullness of this book. There is more in this book than I'll touch on in the time I have to spend in it. If I were to go through it a third time, I would find perhaps more things and do a better job, but I cannot mine the fullness of this book. I'm just going to attempt to uncover the more evident parts. Now, the famine lasted long enough to certainly place some in jeopardy. You never know how long a famine's going to last, and so you hoard and you try to keep as much as you can, and everybody conserves. But there comes a point when you need to make a decision whether you're going to stay there or you're going to move on. And as this famine moved on, it lasted long enough to place some in a position of jeopardy that they needed to make a decision. And Elimelech of Bethlehem, Judah, along with his wife and two sons, were a part of the sum who chose at that point in time, while they still had what they needed to do so, who chose to leave their home and their land. Now, we're told that he chose to go to the country of Moab. By all counts, this does not seem like a wise choice. Every place I looked and everything I did, I could not find any stated reason at all, or any logical reason for that matter, why he went into Moab. Egypt is half the distance away or less, and generally more receptive to immigrants. Most immigrants from Israel would have gone into Egypt. The Moabites, on the other hand, not so much. I mean, they're traveling 1,800 miles into the land of Moab. 1,800 miles in comparison to probably somewhere around 800, a little over 800 to go into Egypt. But the Moabites, on the other hand, now, listen, they were related to Israel. You think, oh, there you go, that's got to be the deal. They're related to Israel. No, they were related to Israel by incest. Moab was the son of Lot, Abraham's nephew, by his oldest daughter. Both of Lot's daughters, after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, feared, and they rightly so, that they would be labeled as women to stay away from. If you're the only ones who walk away from a city that is destroyed by God from heaven, nobody really wants to become your husband. And so those two girls said, if we don't have children, our father's getting old, if we don't have children, we don't have male children, we won't survive in this land. We'll die. And so they concocted a plot, the two of them, to get their father drunk so they could have relationships with him and secure sons. All of that's written in Genesis 19, 30 through 38. When I went through Genesis, I preached it. You want to go back online and listen to it. But listen, both the Moabites from the oldest daughter and the Ammonites, both enemies, for the most part, of Israel, came from that evil plot. And the Moabite women had a reputation for being seducers. They were strategically used as such to infiltrate Israel through the men by King Balak through the prophet Balaam, who Balaam wasn't allowed to prophesy against Israel, and so he said, send them your daughters. They won't be able to say no, and you'll bring idolatry into the nation. And that's exactly what they did. In Deuteronomy 23, verse 3, both the Moabites and the Ammonites were banned forever from entering into the congregation of Israel. That doesn't mean they couldn't come into the land. It means that as Moabites, they could not enter into worship with the nation of Israel. And so if a Moabite woman were to marry a Hebrew man, a Jewish man, she could convert and be considered a part of Israel. But if they remained Moabites or Ammonites, they could not. Moab and Ammon were less than the black sheep of Israel. And yet for some reason that we don't know, Elimelech chooses to go there. For some reason, maybe even he doesn't know for sure. He may not know why he made that choice. Go to Judges chapter 14. Let me give you an example. Judges 14, verses 1 through 4. We're not far away here. With Samson. And it says, and Samson went down to Timnath and saw a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. And he came up and told his father and his mother and said, I've seen a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore, get her for me to wife. Then his father and his mother said unto him, is there never a woman among the daughters of your brethren or among all your people that you go to take a wife of the uncircumcised Philistines? And Samson said unto his father, get her for me, for she pleases me well. This is not a really good exchange, is it? Between parents and son. But his father and his mother knew not, verse 4, that it was of the Lord, and that he sought an occasion against the Philistines. For at that time, the Philistines had dominion over Israel. And so God had a plan going here that his parents didn't know anything about. I'm not even sure that Samson knew anything about it. But nonetheless, we just don't know what the Lord is doing. And it is very seldom what we think he should do. Now we add to this narrative, of a famine and things getting bad enough to have to leave and traveling 1,800 miles in the land of Moab, not necessarily the friendliest country that there was for reasons we're not told. We add this, that Elimelech had two sons. They were named Mahlon. You know what Mahlon means? It means a sick person. This is what they named their kid. And the second one, Kilion, was named Wasting Away. That's what it means. Now, you name kids when they're born, and usually there's some logic to it, unless you're just making something up that sounds cool. Carol Jean remembers two children that were named, the mother called them Lemangelo and Orangelo, but they were spelled Lemon Jello and Orange Jello. And so it all depends on how you pronounce it and what you're trying to accomplish. But evidently these kids were born sickly. And maybe Naomi thought they wouldn't survive, and she named them Sick and Wasting Away. There's Dumb and Dumber and Sick and Sicker here. Now this seems to be a family issue because Elimelech died fairly young. He died at least young enough that he died before his boys were old enough to marry, or at least very close to it. The father died, and then the boys took wives. And they were in Moab, it says, for about 10 years, and they took Moabite wives, and they died. You got a famine. You take what money and goods you got left. You travel 1,800 miles into a foreign country with a foreign people that don't really care for you much. Your husband dies. Your sons take Moabite wives. And then your sons die. So we go from a family of four to a family of three to a family of five to a family of three, all women. Three widows, childless widows in Moab, two resident citizens and one immigrant. Orpah, of whom we know very little, but whose name means stiff-necked, although I don't see anything in the narrative that would indicate she was stiff-necked. And Ruth, of whom we'll know much about as we move along, whose name means refreshment and comfort. And then Naomi, the mother-in-law, who was deeply loved and trusted by the daughter-in-laws, whose name means pleasant. Whatever was going on, Naomi drew people to her that were close to her. They loved her deeply. They were loyal to her. Now, verse 6, in the midst of loss and the unknown future, some good news comes their way. Verse 6 says, then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab how that the Lord had visited his people and given them bread. Good news. They could go home. Three women traveling 1,800 miles back to Bethlehem, Judah. Now, I'm going to say this, that it's unlikely, let's put it that way, because we're not given any details, that they traveled by themselves. It's far more likely that they looked for other bands of people that were traveling. You never traveled alone over that stretch of country. Three women would not have survived that trek, at least logically, providentially, yes. Did they travel, those three women, travel by themselves? I have no idea, but they decided to go back, all the way back to Bethlehem, Judah. Now, when I started this, I called this family insignificant. And what I mean by that is insignificant in the big picture within the tribes as they existed. In other words, these weren't like this wasn't some outstanding family in line for some, or they were in line for some future kingship, but they wouldn't have known that. I mean, nobody in the tribes was looking at them and saying, oh, Elimelech. Everybody would be saying, oh, Elimelech, is he still alive? That guy was sick. Is his son still alive? Sick and sicker? So not key to their present time, nor to the future of Israel at that time. I mean, they weren't involved in anything they knew of, nor anybody else knew of, that had to do with the future of Israel. Nobody would have known any of this. So anybody, any one of us, knowing them, looking at them, wouldn't have thought anything particularly special about that family at all. Nothing. Within the walls of tiny Bethlehem, they were Ephrathites. That's a big deal. That means that they were founding families. They were well known within the city. Wasn't a big city. Probably maybe 7,000 to 9,000 people. So not a lot. But they were well known within the city, and at least and reasonably wealthy, as founding families generally were. At least they were at one time. A time before the famine. A time before the immigration, a time before the three deaths, and now a poverty of sorts. When they return to Bethlehem, Naomi at least will still be known. When she gets there, people will say, is that Naomi? I'm going to grant that after 10 years at least in Moab with the boys and their wives, and I'm not sure how many years prior to that, before the boys took wives, before Elimelech died, or what length of time there was between his death and them taking wives. So maybe 15 years with all the hardships, Naomi probably most certainly did not look the same. Weathered, worn, tired. But they recognized her. Her status, though, had greatly changed. And Naomi herself best expresses how she felt coming home. Turn to Ruth chapter 1, verses 19 through 21. This is how Naomi felt, the great Naomi, and she is a great woman. Verses 19 through 21. So they two went. We're going to get into the part why there's now only two. There's not three women. They started out as three. That's going to change. We'll look at that next week. So they two went until they came to Bethlehem. And it came to pass when they were come to Bethlehem that all the city was moved about them and said, is this Naomi? Everybody's talking about it. It went viral. And she said unto them, call me not Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again, empty. Why then call you me Naomi, seeing the Lord hath testified against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? She automatically assumed that she had done something wrong and that God was bringing a judgment against her. When Naomi says she returned empty, she's saying that everything we left with is gone. Whatever money we had, whatever goods we had, whatever we had, it's all gone. And she believes that this is God's judgment against her. Now, in her day, it was very common to see bad events as judgments from God and good events as blessings from God. That's the way it worked. Job's friends automatically considered that he must have sinned. His kids were dead, his animals were gone, his home's destroyed, he's got boils all over his body, and the friends come down to give him comfort by saying, "What did you do?" Three guys sitting around a fire, and all they can do is try to get him to confess. I don't know if Bob Mueller was there, but they kept pressing the issue. Confess. Because they believed he must have done something wrong. And Job kept saying, "Nothing that I know of." Job had searched his heart. Job had looked to the Lord. If you're going to lose everything you've got except for your wife, and she's telling you to just give it up and die, you'd think you'd know what you did. He says, "But I don't see anything that rises to this." And he stood his ground. But that is the way it worked. If things were going well for you, God was blessing you. If they were not, God was cursing you. Now, correct or not, and it was most often not correct, if you choose a dichotomy, so to speak, in which on one hand you're either getting good things and you're blessed, or you're getting bad things and you're cursed, and there's nothing going on in between here, that's not a good place to work from. But at least they lived their lives looking and understanding that no matter what was going on in their lives, God was involved in it. That they knew. They may not have understood why he was involved or what he was doing. They may have been in error most of the time. But they did know that God's sovereign rule was connected to all of life. 13 times in the 4 chapters of the book of Ruth, the Lord is named as the author of circumstances, good or bad. 13 times. Now, to assume God's intent is not wise. But to deny God's involvement is pure foolishness. As in error as they were about the intent of God and what was really going on, they at least saw that God was involved in the affairs of men. And in our generation, we don't see him at all. We look at everything there is to look at, and maybe, in some cases, and I'm not even just talking about the world, I'm talking about professing Christians, maybe in the end of that we look to see whether God is actually involved in all of this. Listen, folks, as Christians, we must always first assume God is at work. That's Romans 8:28, isn't it? All things work together for the good to them that are the call, to them who love the Lord according to his purposes. All things work together to the good. God is doing something. We must assume that God is at work in our lives. We must assume his hand, but we must not assume that we know what he's doing. You do not know. I can't even begin to make a list right now of all the pronouncements that I've had against myself and some of you have had against you over the course of the last 45 years. People believing that they know what God is doing. Listen, Calvary misinterpreted led the apostles to think that everything was over and done. You're following Jesus. You're convinced he's Messiah. Now, you don't have it all figured out yet. You don't really know what you're talking about. You think that somehow this Jesus is going to build an army up and do away with Rome and set his kingdom up and be ordained as king of the world, for that matter, but certainly of Israel. And you think that's who he is. You got that all wrong, but nonetheless, you're following him. You're listening to him. He's teaching you. You're committed to him. You believe he's the guy. And then he's arrested. He's beaten, hairs pulled out of his face and his head, and he's crucified, and he dies. Wow, did we get this wrong? And now they're going to be after us because we were with him. Let's go hide. And then 3 days later came the first indication that it wasn't over at all. It was actually just getting started. Go to Acts, the book of Acts, chapter 4. We talked on Wednesday night at Bible study, and I asked the question, how many of you that were gathered here on Wednesday, how many of you are idolaters? And surprisingly, most of you raised your hands. And I made the point that even Christians are what we called unintentional idolaters, because you believe things about God that aren't true about God. It's unintentional. It's just because we can't know everything about God. It's because we're limited in our ability to really know him as he is. That's beyond us. He is other. He's so much other that we can't possibly know him. But I'm telling you, we always think we know what he's doing because we always expect him to do certain things a certain way. But what's this say? Acts chapter 4, 26 through 28. It said, the kings of the earth stood up and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ, against the Messiah. For of a truth, against thy holy child Jesus, whom you have anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate with the Gentiles and the people of Israel were gathered together. Look at verse 28. All these people gathered against the Messiah, gathered against Jesus, for to do whatsoever thy hand and thy counsel determined before to be done. If Jesus Christ was not crucified on Calvary, if the wrath of the Father was not poured out on him in our place, and the wrath of men was not moved to put him there, we would not be saved. And that truth didn't even begin to surface until 3 days later. They still didn't understand it, but there he was. We're in a constant state of misinterpreting exactly what God is doing. The famine and the tragedy and the loss in Ruth were so by the determinate counsel of the Lord God. He ordained it so that 1,000 years later, Jesus of Bethlehem, Judah, would come. Ruth was his great-grandmother. Ruth married Boaz, they had Obed. Obed had Jesse. Jesse had David. Leading right to the throne of Jesus. Every single event orchestrated to serve God's purpose. Nothing out of control. Every destination, every loss. Naomi comes back and she can only think that she's done something terribly wrong, with no idea that she's a part of a greater story, written for our instruction to set our eyes above and not below. Listen, Ruth is not about what faithful women can accomplish. You find that book, you throw it away. It's not about what faithful women can accomplish. Ruth is about what God is accomplishing in faithful women. It's about what God is doing in people. It's what he's doing, not about what we're doing. They weren't even, at this point, being faithful to him. They were just doing what they needed to do to survive. Naomi didn't say, "Don't worry about it, Ruthie. Down the road, we're going to be a part of a bigger thing. Let's just trust the Lord." She said, "No, the Lord's mad at me." She didn't even know. These are just women and men, Boaz and others, as instruments in the hands of our faithful God. And the means that he uses to move us to the end that he's determined. That's what it's about. Instruments in the hands of our faithful God. That's all we ever are. Nothing but instruments. He picks us up and he wields us, or nothing happens at all. We serve his purposes. He's not serving ours. They not only didn't know about the future, they couldn't have guessed about that in a billion years. They didn't do a single thing they did to try to attain that goal. They weren't prophesied about prior to this and told by a prophet, "Don't worry about it, things are going to be okay." None of that happened. They were just lost souls in the desert, trying to get back home, trying to adjust to all the loss and all the tragedy. And Naomi feeling like this fell on her for some reason. Do we find ourselves in places like this in our life? Are you there even right now? Things are so out of control and so crazy, you wonder whether the Lord's giving you any blessings at all. And I'm telling you, you don't have a clue what he's doing. And neither do I. If you come and ask me, I'm going to tell you I don't know. I don't even know what he's doing with me. Every time I turn around and I look at something that's happening and I get overwhelmed with all of it, and I wonder what the Lord is doing, and have I overstepped my bounds, and am I going too far? Have I made a wise decision? I the only course of movement I have is to trust him and move forward. Because I don't have answers to any of that, and neither do you. What's the answer to all of that? There is an answer. What is the answer to all of that? Trust him. He knows what he's doing. Trust him. Listen, if you think things are out of control and you think you might have done something wrong, I'm telling you right now, if you've done something, you know what that is. But if you don't and you want to be sure, go to your knees and ask the Lord to reveal whatever it is that needs to be taken care of with you. But I'm telling you that if you've done something that would bring this kind of stuff down on top of you, you know what that is. Otherwise, you trust the Lord that he knows what he's doing. We may be heading in this country for a really hard time. It's hard for me not to think that we are. In the midst of all of that, the Lord will be sorting out his children. And he'll call on us, if that's the case, to trust him. When it looks like everybody's against us and everything's not going our way, they are not seated on the throne. He is. They are not in control. He is. We're simply called to trust him. Amen? Maybe we'll be part of some magnificent insignificance. That we're nobodies. Guess what? We're always nobodies. God's everything, right? All right, let's have prayer, and then we'll close out with a final hymn and benediction.